Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden, and tonight's co-host, appearing courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. Josh is by now well known as a frequent co-host and guest on Your Legal Rights. Mr. Borger practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas.
Here's a topic we're hearing about more and more these days. Your marriage just didn't work out. You and your spouse are going to part company. Simply put, we were not meant to spend this much time with our spouses due to COVID, though. It is what it is. Tonight, we offer a systematic look at the legal process about to begin. We will give your family law update from 30,000 feet.
So, any questions regarding dissolution or child custody or separation of property or support or anything related to family law, give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. That is if you're in the Bay Area. If you're outside of the local dialing area, you can call us toll free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice as we don't have all of the salient facts of your situation, but we're happy to share the legal principles to help guide your decision-making or maybe direct you where you can find some help. You can contact us with any question of family law. You're not limited to the point where we may be in our conversation. And again, the number toll-free is 866-798-8255.
To guide us through this examination of family law, both of tonight's guests appear courtesy of Lonich, Patton, Ehrlich, and Policastri in San Jose. The family law group at Lonich, Patton, Ehrlich, Policastri regularly represents business owners, executives, foreign nationals, and their spouses in complex divorce and family law matters. Our first guest is Gretchen Boger. Gretchen began her career as a deputy district attorney in San Joaquin County. She's been practicing family law exclusively since January 2010. In 2013, Gretchen joined Lonich, Patton, Ehrlich, Policastri, one of the largest family law practices in the state. In 2013, Ms. Boger, she joined in 2013. Ms. Boger is certified as a family law specialist by the California Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California.
Thank you for having me.
After working in real estate finance for several years, Mitchell Ehrlich then went to attend law school at Pepperdine University School of Law, during which time he had temporary assignments with the Washington, D.C. Public Defender's Office, the USDA, and the United States District Bankruptcy Court. Mitch was made a partner at Lonich, Patton, Ehrlich, Policastri in 2007. He practices exclusively in the firm's family law practice, handling a wide variety of family law issues, including dissolution, legal separation, property division issues, custody and support issues, disputes, parentage claims, post-judgment matters, and pre- and post-nuptial agreements. Mr. Ehrlich is certified as a family law specialist by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. And with that, Mitch, Gretchen, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Josh. Thanks for having us.
Nice to be here.
Well, before we go down the bad path of divorces, why don't we start on the path where you're about to get married and everything looks wonderful. So let's start by going down that one. Pre-divorce planning. So what do people need to know about their assets?
Long story short, know what you own and where it's located. You would be surprised the number of people who come to see us who don't know what the community owns, don't know where it is, don't know what their spouse makes, don't know if there's even any retirement accounts. So step one before filing is try to find out as much information about what you own, where your spouse works, Anything you don't know about your assets, try to find out. I would also suggest gathering documents. Statements, bank statements, tax returns, 401k, year-end statements. At some point, usually sooner in the divorce process, you have to fill out what we call disclosures, telling the other side what you know about what the community owns. And that can be very difficult for people who just are not financially focused, for lack of a better term, or just have left that piece of their marriage to their spouse. There's always usually a division of labor in the marriage. And sometimes one party is just not as interested in the financial portion as other, you know, they're focused on other things of the marriage, such as raising children possibly. But the real crux here is hiding assets is a real issue that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. And if I don't have any idea what size the estate is, what banks to be looking at, I'm at a real disadvantage, and therefore my client is. But if I can even be directed in one direction, you know, I think most of our assets are at this bank, that's really going to help me focus my requests, and we'll get to discovery a little bit later. But I have a lot of tools in my bag for discovery. The last one I want to use, however, is throwing the wide fishing net, not knowing where I'm looking, because I could miss something. And the good news is we have the spouse that does not know about the finances. They are protected. The law has changed over the years to protect that party. And if one side is found to be purposefully hiding things, or even maybe not purposefully hiding things, the court has a sanction ability to kind of help even the playing field if it was purposeful. That's the key in hiding assets. But the bottom line really is look around your house and get the tax returns. Tell me everything. Tell your divorce lawyer everything you know. Mitch, anything I've left out?
No, I thought that was great. The only thing I would probably add, and this is more big picture, and of course it may be easier said than done, but think about your goals. What are your short-term goals? What are your long-term goals? Short-term, do you want to move out? Do you want the other spouse to move out? What's your thoughts on custody? Again, easier said than done, and there may be many instances where it comes as a shock. It could come out of the blue. It could come out of the fact that someone's getting hauled off to jail because there was some domestic abuse issue. But if you could start to think about your goals, what's your end game here? Not end game, but where would you like to be when this is all over? Do people agree? Is this something we've been talking about for a while? And maybe there are more areas in common than otherwise. But obviously, if you don't know what your goals are, or if you're in a state of shock, which the majority of our folks are, I think the planning that Gretchen talked about is exactly what you need, because we meet people every day that there are still a lot of either separate finance families, or I guess I'd call them, you know, throwbacks, where we still have the stay-at-home father or mother, and they just don't seem to know a lot. And of course, life is complicated now, and it is difficult to really know what's going on. Of course, we have power dynamics within relationships. I know Gretchen can talk about this for days, so can I. We have folks that aren't allowed to see what is out there. They don't get access. I get clients who still, they call it an allowance. My husband gives me an allowance. That's a bad way to start, but it's obviously something we can address.
You know, we've done some recent shows that make me want to throw something back at you. You talked about spouses hiding assets. And it seems to me that in today's world, there's probably I don't know. I don't want to say there's a lot more of that going on, but I bet people are a lot better at it today with greater communication, more worldwide access to different places, and the whole advent of cryptocurrency. Seems to me it's a whole lot harder to find those assets, or it should be. Either one of you gotten in those battles and have any insights for us on and really how to try to keep things on a level playing field where you can find all these assets?
Well, the good news for our listeners is that, you know, we employ forensic CPAs. So you're not, you know, my job is to know the law. The CPA that we would employ will literally go line by line through bank statements and trace that money and tell me where it goes and where they think it went. If there's been some investment in cryptocurrency, which we are seeing more and more of, the good news is that it's treated semi-similarly to stock because the value is so volatile. So however many, you know, shares of Bitcoin you own, if those are community, they get equally divided. So that's the good news. No matter if it's worth 3 cents or, you know, $3 million a share. But I will say we don't see people are not becoming more and more successful at hiding assets. I have not had people become more successful at it. I mean, it's a type of personality that you get in divorce court who thinks they can pull the wool over the eyes of either their attorney or the other attorney or the judge. But I am very clear with my clients that if they don't tell me that there's something out there and they don't disclose it to me and we don't put it on our disclosures, they could very well be sanctioned and their spouse ordered to have 100% of that asset. That's a real sanctionability by the court.
And we certainly get a lot of people accusing their spouse of hiding assets. I can't recall the last client meeting I had where that accusation didn't come up. And certainly as a professional, we will look for it. It happens. As Gretchen said, people aren't as successful. People think they're clever, and there are very clever people. We live in a community in Silicon Valley where there are a lot of smart people, but there are a lot of documentation that follows bank transfers, wire transfers out of the country. I obviously cannot advise clients to do this, but to the extent that there is some, I don't want to use the word success, but an effort that is difficult to unwind, often it involves small businesses or businesses that the party can control where they can move money back and forth. We had a case where client, I won't name the name, but they had two sets of books. We discovered both sets, which was obviously very helpful with the help, as Gretchen said, of a forensic accountant. But and I tell you, the courts do not suffer individuals who try to hide assets. When you get caught, you are caught red-handed, and it's not good. But we employ good folks, smart CPAs, who I have every confidence will find every dollar that's hidden if it's out there.
And there's a duty on spouses, people who are married, to voluntarily disclose all information about community property assets and any possible separate property assets. And that's called fiduciary duties of spouses. So if you are found to have breached your fiduciary duty, the courts, especially recently, take that very, very seriously because there's a malicious intent there and you owe your spouse the highest duty of care and disclosure. So by breaching that, the court comes down pretty hard.
With that, let me take a call from Dagwood and LaHonda. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Hi, welcome. Jeff. Thank you. So I got divorced in 2016. And at that time, I had visitation of my two children on Sundays from 10 to 8 o'clock. But very shortly after that, my ex and I decided that we were going to do a 50-50 split where I had them, from Monday to Monday, and I would drop them off at her house. That went on for about 5 years until about a couple months ago when she discovered that I was seeing someone new, and now she doesn't want me to see my kids. And so I'm trying to go back to court. My question is, am I going to be stuck with the original order of only Sundays, or will I have a good chance of having 50-50 since that's what we were doing? Thank you.
Hi. So great question. And I do have to give a little bit of a caveat. Custody can be treated very differently from county to county. Every county has is able to make their own custody process. But generally speaking, and I'll answer this as broadly as I can, you should file a motion, and you would rely on what we call the status quo. If there's been any change in your custody orders between what the order says and the schedule that you're actually following, you would tell the court that you have a new status quo. That's the term that the court refers to when you're doing something differently in custody without an order or change from an order. So the court relies heavily on what the status quo is. So my recommendation would be that you file a motion and tell the court that there's been a change and this is what you've been doing for 5 years. That's a significant length of time. The child has a right to rely on the consistency of that custody schedule. And changing it back just because someone finds out that you're dating someone else is not in the child's best interest.
And Gretchen, what would you tell our caller if they were going in front of the judge? What evidence should they, how could he prove that he's had 50-50 custody?
Well, if you have a calendar that you've been keeping, I encourage my clients to keep a log on a calendar of when they have their children. If you have any text messages that between yourself and your ex-spouse that can confirm pickups and drop-offs, emails, even third-party witnesses, neighbors who know that your children are at your home 50% of the time, every Monday, Tuesday. You have little Billy and little Jane. All of that is relevant evidence that the court wants to hear to rely on what you're saying.
And to our caller, just understand when the judge is hearing your case, you're looking at assuming they accept your facts as accurate, and with that evidence that Gretchen talked about, you shouldn't have a problem. But now you've got 5 years where the kids, all they know is half time with dad, half time with mom. And now this is a dramatic change. This is a life changing situation that your ex-wife, the children's mother, is trying to put in place. Now, obviously, if we could dial back the clock, what we would say is when you and the ex made this agreement that you put it in writing in what we call a stipulation, which is a fancy word for a written agreement that the party signed and filed with the court. And then you have a binding court order, and then she can't do these kinds of things, certainly not without violating the order and getting in trouble with contempt. But we have a lot of parents, and we obviously encourage parents. You don't need to rush down to court every time you agree to things. But obviously, if you're making a long-term permanent change, that's when it happens. And if not everybody's willing to do that, that's a concern. But I hope you're in good shape, and this may be a good opportunity to think about retaining some counsel to get in front of that judge and really pursue that claim, get the evidence you need, and hopefully you'll get a good result.
Dagwood, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Let me turn it to Jody in Oakland. Jody, you're in Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hi there. I had bought a house prior to getting married, and when I refinanced during Brexit, we had gotten married and we didn't sign any sort of a prenup, and so now I'm trying to refinance again, and the house is jointly owned, He, you know, he's on the mortgage, he's on the deed. But I still think of this as really being my house that I bought, looked for, all of that. And so we're still on good terms. And I'm wondering if there's anything that I can do now, like in terms of like a postnup or some sort of way that we can work out a situation for the future where if we were to divorce, like my assets would be protected.
This is a scenario that we see often, and it's a tough one because I'm assuming that when you went in for that refinance, you weren't necessarily thinking I'm going to add him to title and give him half of my interest. And unfortunately, California law seems to suggest the other way, that at least going forward from the time they were put on title, that the house then becomes shared asset, a community asset. California is a community property state, and the putting him on title, it has the effect of saying that property is now community property. It doesn't mean that all the equity becomes community. In fact, there's an exception that's not really an exception. It just is the law that the equity that you had at the time that you put this other person on title, your spouse, remains yours. But that doesn't solve your bigger question, which is, can I prevent that? Can I do something to fix it? And the answer is yes. It's a postnuptial agreement. Postnuptial agreements are like prenuptial agreements. They're agreements between spouses that address assets, support, or otherwise. Whether he'll sign this, I don't know. But this is the best way that I can see to try to resolve this issue. And ultimately, if he agreed to sign a postnup, and I would recommend that each side at least consult with an attorney. And ultimately, I think to make an agreement like this enforceable, or let's say as enforceable as possible, you'd want to have both sides having attorneys. But ultimately, if you could come up with an agreement that ensures that the house remains your separate property regardless, ultimately he'd also have to, assuming he signed this agreement, sign a quit claim deed or an interspousal deed, something that takes his name off title. Obviously, like we talked about earlier, easier said than done, but that would be your sort of your resolution or your best course of action. Simply taking him down to the escrow agent and having him sign a deed, it feels like you've resolved it, but we see that fact pattern come up a lot. And ultimately, that doesn't necessarily get the outcome that you want. You'd need a postnuptial agreement, certainly something in writing that clearly delineates that I am disavowing any interest in this property. It's entirely your separate property. And the best way to do that is to meet with an attorney, walk through the steps for a postnuptial agreement, present it to your spouse, and presuming he signs it, get your issue resolved.
And just to jump in here, you have an interesting set of facts because prior to marriage, anything you put into that house, that's going to be yours, your separate property, including any run-up in value. And then California law supports when you added your husband, as long as you were married, to title, that, as Mitch stated, that's going to transmute that property presumptively to community property. And community property law is going to give any run-up in value, which we all know is the majority of the, you know, worth the value in the homes here in the Bay Area, it's going to move the run-up in value into the communities column, and your separate property would then become capped at whatever it was on the date of marriage or when you added him to title, depending on exactly how those facts shake out. So in order to get him to opt out of his community's interest, especially if you're using your earnings to pay on that mortgage, that requires a postnup, a fairly significant for him to admit that he has a community property interest and he's waiving that, as Mitch said.
Okay.
Jody, I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, that was very helpful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. Tonight's hosts are Jeff Hayden and Josh Borger. We're joined by certified family law specialists Mitch Ehrlich and Gretchen Boger, both out of San Jose. Tonight, we're taking a 30,000-foot view of family law. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. We will pay the freight. So call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topics, anything about family law. You're not limited to the exact point where we may be in our conversation.
So you finally decided you're going to get the divorce. You have children. Where do you go from here? What's the process?
Well, Jeff or Josh, I'll step in on that one. And Jeff, you were talking about 30,000 feet, and I use that phrase a lot because from 30,000 feet, process is not terribly complicated. Obviously, when we get to ground level, that's a different story. But the process starts sort of innocuously. We file this petition. Again, this assumes this is we're not in an emergency situation. We can talk about that separately. But where we've been married a long time, I'm done, I'm finished. The petition for dissolution, one of the most simple and innocuous documents that yet has such a significant impact on people's lives. It's a check the box form. It's very easy. It's $420, $440 fee to file, and that starts the process. Of course, that is step one of many steps in a long process. I tell clients, I analogize it to you buy a ticket to get on a train. You don't know where that train's going. It hasn't left the station until your spouse gets on board, and in this case, files a response to the petition. So you filed, got it back, served it. They respond. Now that train's moving. Where we go from there sort of depends on what the parties want to do, whether they are at odds, whether there's issues that need to go in front of a judge quickly. But assuming, again, staying at 30,000 feet, we do what we talked about at the beginning. We marshal up the assets. We inventory. What community assets? We inventory, we characterize, are they community, are they separate? We value them. What are the value? And then hopefully we can work out a division. At the same time, we hopefully address support and custody issues. Again, this is 30,000 feet, perfect world. Assuming we get an agreement, we negotiate the terms, draft it up in a settlement agreement, submit it for judgment. Now, that is the ideal, simple 30,000-foot case. And, Gretchen and I, we don't work at 30,000 feet. We work at ground level, and things don't often, and let's be honest, rarely go that way. Certainly, that's most folks' goal when they come in here. And we certainly try to achieve that goal, but it doesn't always happen. But the process can start fairly simply, and then where you go from there, we'll see.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, this is Felix Contreras. This week on Art Latino, we turn to the headlines for a look at Latinos and Latina artists making the news this week. From In the Heights to Los Lobos to symphonic music, you're not going to want to miss this on the next Alt Latino, right here on your favorite NPR station. Don't miss it.
Alt Latino, tonight at 8:30, preceded by All Songs Considered, coming in for the 8 o'clock hour, and cue from the CBC for the 7 o'clock hour here on member-supported KALW San Francisco. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So before we get much further, Mitch, you were just talking to us about the view when we're not really at 30,000 feet and things don't always go according to plan. And as a criminal practitioner, I can't think of anything that would upset the plan more than where your world and my world meet. And that is when somebody introduces domestic violence into the relationship. Let's talk a little bit about that and how an emergency situation can change the whole dynamic of how we proceed.
Gretchen, why don't you take this one?
Certainly. Thank you, Jeff. So we have in family court what we call a domestic violence restraining order, which is separate and apart from a criminal restraining order or an emergency protective order that a police officer may issue to the victim at the scene of a crime. So if you have an emergency protective order or if there are pending charges, that's a very important point that you will want to include on your domestic violence restraining order with the family court. The family court is always interested in whether criminal court is moving forward or not, because it can have an impact on how quickly the family court can move. But in short, if there has been domestic violence in your home, and domestic violence is not just defined as, you know, physical, hitting, emotional, verbal, the legislature in California, especially with the COVID shutdown and the COVID lockdown, has expanded the definition of domestic violence to include what they have called coercive control, which can be any type of manipulation, what's also termed as gaslighting, manipulation and keeping people where they don't want to be without hitting, without possibly verbal abuse. So the crux here is the family court is and wants to be helpful and wants to protect victims from any sort of abuse that they're suffering at this time. And the good news is if you fill out the domestic violence restraining order, and it is a form and it is available on every county website, I can tell you about how quickly we're processing them in Santa Clara County. You can plan to get those turned around in 48 hours, sometimes less. So family court understands that there's an emergency situation, especially with COVID, with people being kind of trapped in the same homes, and they want to get people access to temporary orders. And that's what the court will issue when a domestic violence restraining order is submitted to it. So if you have children, you want to list your children on the domestic violence restraining order. You want to list if you will be doing some sort of exclusive use and possession of any sort of home. It can be an apartment, it can be a condo, it can be a standalone family residence. You also want to list who's going to be paying that mortgage, or request from the court to make an order that if the person who's been violent with you pays the mortgage and is the primary wage earner, you can request the court to order them to pay the mortgage at least until the first hearing. So these domestic violence restraining orders and the temporary orders that are granted are going to be very broad, at least for the first 30 to 45 days. And what we're seeing in Santa Clara County is the court is really trying to give a cooling off period. Let's break this bad cycle of violence. Let's break these people apart for a while, have a cooling off period, bring them back to court in 30 to 45 days. That's the target that the family court will try to bring people back on their first hearing. Now, with the good news is that in Santa Clara County, we're hearing that the courts are going to be opening up very, very soon. There has been an impact on how frequently departments are open, but I have to applaud Santa Clara County. They're doing a great job, especially of moving through the domestic violence restraining orders and getting some sort of cooling off period relief for the violence initially. And then once people have had a chance to take a cooling off period, they come back to court, and usually cooler heads prevail. I would encourage anyone who's looking at needing to file a domestic violence restraining order to talk to an attorney, because a domestic violence restraining order has a fairly drastic effect on custody, especially initially on that 30 to 45 day period. There could be an order for no visitation to one parent. So that's a pretty significant impact. It can also have an impact on support. Child support is always based on the timeshare. So if you have no time with your children, that's going to impact support. Could possibly impact spousal support, depends on the situation. And definitely has an impact on assets, at least temporarily, because someone would possibly be awarded temporary use of the home. That's kind of a 30,000 foot view of that. There's many, many more specifics depending on the facts of your case. Mitch, do you want to hit on anything else?
Yeah, no, that was great. I guess I would add that, you know, Jeff, your example started with the intersection of criminal law and family law. Of course, as we know, domestic violence is complex, and not every domestic violence act is reported to the police, but that should not stop or deter people. If you're being abused, the Domestic Violence Prevention Act has a framework set up to provide for protection, as Gretchen described. And of course, it's not always easy to report these things to the police. Sometimes the police don't know what to do. Things like coercive control or maybe stalking or harassment may not rise to the level of something where a law enforcement officer would arrest someone, but that shouldn't deter somebody from seeking that. Now, on the flip side, if you are the person who has been served with a domestic violence restraining order, read that order, follow that order. If it says get out of the house, get out of the house. When it says don't contact your spouse, do not contact your spouse. Don't tell your brother or your buddy to call them. Follow the order, retain counsel, get to court, and you can defend yourself. You can address the claims. And often what we see is there may be domestic violence, and that's terrible, but it doesn't always result in the abuser, the alleged abuser, let's say, we have to say that here, never, ever, ever seeing their child again. Sometimes it can. And again, domestic violence has a significant impact, not only on the victim, but on the children, of course, whether they're directly affected or they're just witnessing this. But follow those orders. Don't try to contact them and convince them otherwise. You have your opportunity, like Gretchen said, in 25, 30, 35 days. And unfortunately, from a judge's perspective, 35 days, 40 days in the life of a child is a small bit. Obviously, they want to ensure that kids get to be with their parents. But if it's that cooling off period that's needed, go cool off. And if you have a problem, call someone like us, but also maybe get yourself into counseling. Show the court, hey, I want to do better.
You know, what? One thing I'll add, you mentioned, Mitch, about calling a lawyer, and let me give two reasons that our listeners should seriously consider that when they receive such an order. One, of course, is the orders are at a set timeline. Oftentimes, the family courts have a separate division for domestic violence, and your lawyer may be instrumental in getting you in sooner in the appropriate situation where you really do need to move things up, and there's a reason to think that the playing field hasn't been leveled. But the other reason is, as Mitch said, don't talk to the person who's got this petition, even through a third party, even through a family member. But those things never apply to your attorney of record. So your lawyer can call their lawyer, if they're not represented, can call them directly and intervene. And it's the only likelihood you have of being able to communicate those desires. So one more reason to talk to a lawyer.
Yeah. And that's a good point, Jeff. Some, I don't mean to interrupt, but sometimes they can negotiate interim custody. Sometimes there can even be some opportunity to resolve things after that cooling off period. So very good points.
And that's where your lawyer's knowledge of the intricate custody custody for each county would come in, because if you're worse familiar with what, you know, how to fast track a case and move you into at least some type of contact with your children instead of no contact, any type of contact is going to be better than no contact with your children. So definitely contact a lawyer who would be familiar with the custody path in the county that you're in.
We did get a message from a longtime listener who wanted me to convey the following question to you two. This person is the recipient of a long-term alimony award. In particular, is completely dependent on alimony and alimony alone for income. And this person asks, what happens if my ex passes away before alimony is scheduled to end in 8 years? Does this person become a beneficiary of the person's life insurance policy or their company's insurance policy? Does that person's status get them into first position for their estate as a debt obligation? Is there something set up to try to make this person whole again?
Interesting question, Jeff. Thank you. And I'll take the first stab here. Generally speaking, permanent spousal support awards are not forever. And when, I mean, they are finite in that they would not run past death. So if one party or the other passes away, even though there may be an order that says you're set to receive spouse support for 25 years, the payor spouse passes away at, let's say, year 18, there's no claim, generally speaking, that can be made against the estate. There are other, precautions and orders that can be put into the permanent spousal support order, which would be a lot of times we request some type of life insurance, some type of roughly guarantee that if someone does pass away, and these are the cases of long-term support when both parties are later in life, there is a life insurance policy that this supported spouse, the spouse receiving support, can request when you're negotiating that support award. It should be roughly, I mean, the amount depends on how much somebody's getting per month and how long that order is projected to go. But generally speaking, if there has been no security for support, that's kind of the lawyer term we use for it, there can not be a claim made against the estate. Mitch, your thoughts on that?
I agree. And it's something that it doesn't necessarily jump out at the page, but things like life insurance, really, in especially in long-term marriages, particularly, let's say we have a spouse who may be beyond what we call work life. Maybe they're in their late 50s or their early 60s. They haven't worked. And yes, our goal is obtain as much for as long, as much spousal support. Used to call it alimony. Now we call it spouse support. It's all the same thing. But we have to do a little bit of financial planning. We have to start thinking about not only, you know, sort of how much and for how long, but what is that going to mean? And then there's contingencies. Ultimately, we can't always assess for the contingencies. I always talk to people, well, look, your spouse may become disabled. They may die early. You may become disabled. There's a lot of different contingencies, but life insurance is a fantastic tool, and the court can order it. The parties can agree to it. And it is in that, you know, Jeff, in the question that you posed, that would really be what we're looking at. I have seen agreements occasionally with spousal support that attempt to go past death, if it's specifically worded that way, you might be able to pursue it. You know, interesting, we were talking about spousal support in the past few years with the changes in the tax law. Spousal support used to be taxable to the recipient, tax deductible to the payor, the person who's writing the check every month. And that was where that, you know, death of either party, which we tend to see in orders, or remarriage of the spouse comes into automatically terminated. But we always put that language in there. And of course, because if you're deceased, you're not earning and you don't necessarily have the ability to pay. But you could negotiate that, but it's pretty rare. And certainly as a lawyer, if I'm representing the payor spouse, the person writing the checks, unless they absolutely want to have their estate be bound, we're terminating at death. But then that's where that life insurance policy comes in. And of course, you can decide who pays that. Sometimes it's the recipient who pays for support. But that's a great question, though. Something we see quite a bit.
So we were talking about support. Let's keep going. Why don't we tell people exactly what is child and spousal support? A good definition of that. One of the questions that I have is, if somebody has a few ex-wives or children from other marriages, what happens if you have orders for spousal support or child support, multiple orders it could be, and you just don't have the money to pay them all?
Good question, Josh. So in California, the legislature has mandated that we use the guideline formula. And that can be via the DisoMaster, that's the program. It can be via ex-spouse. But generally speaking, it's a guideline formula with child support specifically, that the court calculates based on each party's income. And there will be an input if you're paying child support for another child of another marriage. So not the child of this marriage, but a child from a previous marriage, and that will be a deduction. And the interesting thing is, whoever gets an order first, there would be more net spendable income available for that first child. So if you're, you know, later in line, there's only so much income to go around, right? People only earn so much income. And the court has to award it as it's applied, right? As the children come, as the orders are made. So if you have a child from a first marriage and you're paying a child support order, now it has to be pursuant to an order. It won't be good. You won't be first in line if you don't have an order from a court. And that first child will have more net spendable income going towards them and each subsequent child thereafter.
And with this, you sort of talked about, I can't pay. And of course, the truth is in the eye of the beholder here. But if you truly can't pay, you get laid off from your job, you suffer a financial calamity. If you have existing orders, you need to seek a modification order, spouse support, child support, what have you. Because if you just sit back and do nothing, and let's say you just stop paying, that's a bad outcome because you will get hauled into court at some point, whether it be on what we call arrears, which is simply a term for unpaid child support, unpaid spousal support. And it's taxed at 10% interest. I use the word tax, but it's by law, a child support order is akin to a judgment. And once you're 30 days late, 10% interest is tacked on top of that. In extreme cases, if you're what we call delinquent or owing arrears, the matter can get in front of what's called the Department of Child Support Services, who their collection efforts, we can collect on child support. We can attach liens, garnish wages. The Department of Child Support Services, their net is far greater. They can garnish tax returns. They can suspend licenses. Josh or Jeff, I know you're in great family relationships, but if either of you fell behind and fell delinquent, the DCSS could technically attempt, let's say, to suspend your bar license. I don't think that would really work because then you wouldn't be able to practice law. So that doesn't necessarily make sense. But I have seen passports get revoked. I've seen tax returns get garnished. So if you cannot pay, and I don't want to, don't come in here and tell me you just got back from a 3-week round the world vacation, or don't show up in your brand new car. But if you are out of work, if you truly cannot pay because your income exceeds or you just simply can't manage it, then you got to go in and get it modified. However, just understand that your expenses, your income, all that is fair game. And it is not a good excuse that your, you know, that your monthly Tesla payment is too big and you can't afford to pay support. What's the judge going to say? Get rid of your car. Take the bus.
You know, and what you didn't add is in an extreme case, they can find that person in contempt and actually hang jail over their head.
Absolutely.
And as they pay it down, the jail days go away. And if they fall behind, they're going to get a few days as a sanction. And yeah. I've defended that case, and it ain't pleasant.
No. You know, you hear the term deadbeat dad. It's a euphemism, but it's the classic parent that can pay, that won't pay. At some point, because it's a court order, not only can it be enforced as a money order, but as Jeff said, it's a court order. And to violate a court order makes you potentially liable for contempt. And a contempt, even though it's done in civil court, it's done in family court, it's not the district attorney or the prosecutors. We, as family law attorneys, more or less become the prosecutor. And if you're found guilty of contempt for willfully violating a court order to pay support, you can and will potentially go to jail, pay fines, do community service. And then even if you, let's say you don't go to jail, they put you on probation. And Jeff, I know this is in your wheelhouse. One of the terms of the probation is make every payment on time. And so if you miss another payment after you've been found guilty of contempt, then it's a no-brainer. You're going to spend a night or two in jail and maybe more.
Well, let's say that before you have any order and you know you're about to have an order, so instead of working 40 hours a week, you decide, I'm only going to work 20 because I'm going to lose all my money anyway. And so you go and the judge sees you've decided you're a part-time person. Can the judge order you to, can they make you pay based on 40 hours a week and you have to go out there and find other money? Can they order you to find another job? How does it work if it appears that you have just voluntarily decided to lower your income?
Well, so the key there is it purposeful? Does the court think it's purposeful, or does the court not think it's purposeful? So if you've always worked 20 hours a week, what the court will do is say, okay, the court can issue what's called a seek work order or for you to increase your hours. According to the family court, full time is 32 hours a week. So as long as you're working 32 hours a week, a court is not going to issue another seek work order or issue you to increase your hours or anything like that. However, if you are working a full-time job, let's say you're a salaried employee, and you either get yourself fired by some sort of, really poor decision, or you purposefully reduce your income, tell your boss you want to cut your hours to 20 hours a week instead of 40, the court can do what's called impute income to you. And that's sort of a scary thing, because the court is putting in your column on the DisoMaster money that you don't actually have. The court is saying you purposefully lowered your income, so I'm going to put full-time income in your column, and you are going to pay support based on full-time income that you don't actually have. A court can do that also for people who refuse to find a job. If the court has issued a seek work order and the court thinks that the person is just purposefully not finding a job, that they're well qualified, they have training, experience, and they're just not finding a job, a court can also impute income to that person, but they would probably do so in small increments at a time. Say start at minimum wage, and then depending on how long the litigation is going, they could come back and impute maybe a little higher over longer periods of time.
And folks, real quick point. When you said the word DisoMaster, you're talking about the software the court uses to figure out who makes what, who pays out what. But with that, let me shift over, because we're almost out of time. And I did want to give you a chance to talk about how you divide up debts and assets. Can you walk us through a little bit of that?
Oh, that's easy. 50-50, right down the middle. Obviously, it's not that easy. At the beginning, we were talking about marshaling or doing an inventory of the assets. What's there? Houses, cars, stock, retirement, credit card debt, et cetera. Generally, assuming it's all community property and there is an assumption that if it's been acquired, earned, amassed during marriage, it's community property. So we find those assets. Obviously, things like bank accounts, we can divide those relatively easily. Houses, we can't. We can't just split a house in half. So then we're talking about a buyout from one spouse to the other. Unfortunately, sometimes properties need to be sold. But not everything is community property, and that's where it gets certainly more complex. And Gretchen, I know you've had some cases recently where there's a lot of separate property issues or intermingled separate property issues. What do we do there?
So if you own something prior to marriage, an example was that second caller. She owned her house prior to marriage. Anything you own prior to marriage, get documentation of it. Get a bank statement or a mortgage statement the month prior to marriage, and that will show us exactly what your separate property claim is that we're working with. Anything you inherit, any gift, devise, anything like that is gifted just to you from a parent, a grandparent, an aunt, wealthy uncle, that is your separate property and would not fall into the community property presumption. So you're entitled to be awarded that asset at 100% of its value instead of 50%.
But of course, it gets more complicated when you have community property that maybe didn't start out that way, or maybe is, separate assets are really being used to prop it up, or separate property that perhaps we're doing stuff together that's making it worth something. It gets to be kind of a blurry line, doesn't it?
So it does. Talking about commingling. That's commingling of assets that generally requires some type of forensic tracing. I mentioned that at the beginning of the hour. We employ a lot of forensic CPAs. They will do a line by line tracing of where did that separate property come into this account? What did it purchase? Where did it go? It takes a lot of statements. You have to go line by line, statement by statement, year by year, depending on how many years you're looking at.
Well, I think we all just found out over the past hours that buying your spouse flowers is a lot cheaper than a divorce.
That is true.
Amen to that. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights as we took a view of family law from 30,000 feet. Our guest tonight, appearing courtesy of Lonich, Patton, Ehrlich, and Polcastery in San Jose, have been Gretchen Boger and Mitchell Ehrlich. Tonight's show was produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. I'd like to thank you for joining us, all of our guests, and all of you for joining us tonight. And please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week at our usual time, Wednesday at 6, where we'll take a close look at the cases now emerging from this, a very tumultuous term at the United States Supreme Court. Our thanks to all of you for joining us, and at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.